Well, what I thought I'd do this morning is sort of set the scene for the feast. I have 5 points. We joke about the 5 points. I don't normally commit myself, then you don't know how many I've got, but I'm going to stick my neck out this morning. First of all, I'd like to discuss the 7,000-year plan of God. I want to just run quickly through the history as to what's actually happened. The second point is chocolate. The third point is a floor plan for the last 80 years. And the fourth point is, what are we actually doing here? Why us? Why here? And the fifth point, which the children will like, are we aliens? So let's start off. I'm just going to quote scriptures if you want to make a note of them. I want to run through 6,000 years of a few people. As Mr. Ball said last night, I woke up at 4 o'clock thinking about what he was saying last night, because it ties in exactly with this. It's a 6,000 years of a handful of people making the right decision. A handful of people making the right decisions. We start off with Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, as in Genesis 3. Mr. Armstrong, in The Mystery of the Ages, sums it up by saying, man built his world on self-sufficiency without God. God set in motion a master plan for accomplishment of his purpose, consisting of a duration of 7,000 years. Satan was allowed to remain on earth's throne for the first 6,000 years. Guess where we are today? Very, 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 very close to that 6,000th year. God purposed that man must learn his lesson and come voluntarily to accept God's way and character. God wants us to make that decision. He's not going to force eternal life on anybody. Today, man's world is reeling on its last legs. You feel Mr. Armstrong wrote this last night, don't you? Wars, violence, destruction, terrorism engulf the entire world. Half the world exists in ignorance, illiteracy, poverty, living in filth and squalor. The developed half is sick with ill health, disease, mental stress, fear, frustration, racked with crime, alcoholism, drug abuse, perverted and misused sex, broken homes, hopelessness, in frustration. Mankind is nearing the end of his rope. He could have written that last 2 or 3 days. Because that's exactly where we are now. 6,000 years of mankind making the wrong decisions. We then go on to Cain and Abel in Genesis 4. Just a small point here, and this I've heard people argue in the church over this over the years, that, you know, did God really have time to teach Adam his law? And you know, that is so ludicrous, because the slaying of Abel was a sin. There was a punishment involved. And if there's no law, then there's no punishment. You can't be punished for driving at 60 miles an hour down the freeway when the speed limit's 70. It's obvious that God's law was actually in force at that particular time. Well, Abel didn't have long to live. And then we go into Genesis, we got right up to Genesis 5. We have Enoch. It is absolutely stunning to think that from the creation of Adam to the flood was 1656 years. You can check down all the genealogies, you can work it out. 1656 years, and there were 3 righteous men mentioned: Abel, Enoch, and Noah. We're not told very much about Enoch. James, if you make a note, Jude 1 verse 14, he said, Enoch also, the 7th from Adam, prophesied of these, saying, behold, the Eternal comes with 10,000s of his saints. Enoch obviously understood at least a good part of God's plan. Because obviously, if these saints are coming with Christ, then they must be spirit. Because Christ is spirit. So Enoch knew what was going on. And Enoch preached for 300 years. Enoch witnessed against everybody from his great-great-great-great-grandfather, Adam, who was well alive when he was preaching, right up to Methuselah, who was in fact, I believe, his own son. For 300 years, he was preaching righteousness. We're not told as to what the result of all this was, except that God had to take him away. He died He died very young by standards in those days. But then we come to Noah. Genesis 6, God looked down on this earth, and he basically realized that it had had it. If he hadn't wiped those people out, they were becoming so perverted that it would have been impossible to retrain them in the White Throne Judgment period. They were going so far off track. And aren't we in that same case today? There are people today whose minds are so perverted, they're calling good evil and evil good. They're totally mixed up to where we're going to have to be careful how we explain certain things, because this stuff goes out on the internet. Everybody can get access to what I'm saying right now. And if somebody gets upset because I said something that upset them, they can sling me in jail. That's how perverted things have become. You can't explain God's way without taking a risk of being slung in jail. It's that bad. Noah, in Genesis 7 verse 1, the Eternal said unto Noah, come you and all your house into the ark, for you have I seen righteous before me in this generation. It doesn't mention anything about his wife or his children. He said you. Three men, 1656 years. That's stunning. And you go down to Genesis 10. Enter stage right, Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Eternal. Nimrod and his mother Semiramis, in actual fact, laid the foundations for what became the Catholic Church. You can check the history. And of course, he then started a city. And of course, that city is Babel. Genesis 11, verse 6, and the Eternal said, behold, this people is one, and they have one language, and this they begin to do, and now nothing will be restrained from them. You see how quick human development can take place? If you think everything that we have today basically has happened in the last 200 years, from 1800. Before 1800, it was horses and carts. And then came the Industrial Revolution and so on, and now we sit here, and people down in Africa and the Philippines can listen to me live right now, and later on they can just re-record the thing and pump it out over speakers in America. Mr. Armstrong never had those facilities. It's utterly amazing what we've got. And God confounded their language, and he scattered them all over the face of the earth, because that's what he told man to do in the first place. He said, go out and populate the earth. And man says, no, we're going to live in cities. That's our decision. So God says, no, you're going to scatter. And this is how I'm going to scatter you. And I remember a wonderful example. When I was 16, we were living down in what was then Rhodesia or Zimbabwe. And we moved down to South Africa. And we went down, my dad and I went down on the train. And at the time, there was the Biafran conflict on. What was the Belgian Congo in the sort of old days of empire. And we had a lot of Belgian people. We had French people. We had a couple of German people. We had my dad, obviously from Scotland. They don't speak English up there, really, do they? And there was a few other people from different nations. And we had a problem, because nobody could understand each other. Now, you must understand, back in those days, apartheid ruled. And on the train, which was a South African Railways train, all the staff were Afrikaans, right? Very Afrikaans. They would really labor to speak to you in English, because they didn't like the English. And this goes back to the Boer War and all the rest of it. And by the end of the night, they were so frustrated, because what happened was nobody could communicate. It was terrible. And so somebody, my dad, I think, had a bit of schoolboy French. But you know how they ended up talking? The Bantu languages, the African languages, have got certain words in common. So here you had all these white folk on a South African train communicating using predominantly the black people's language. And it was utterly astounding. And even then, I remember thinking then, you know, this is like something out of a movie. It was crazy. And by the end of the evening, even the staff were warming to the situation. But otherwise, we would have had no way of communicating. So God was very clever in that he forced the nations to spread out and populate the earth. 2000 BC, approximately, we have Abraham. Genesis 12, verse 1. And the Eternal said to Abraham, as he was then, get thee out of your country and from your kindred and from your father's house into a land that I will show you, and I will make of you a great nation. This is the start. This is the foundation. This is the bedrock of the people of Israel. And it's interesting. There's a couple of scriptures you make a note of. 2 Chronicles 20, verse 7. I'll just read it quickly. He says, you know, God says, are you not our, Abram says, are you not our God who does drive out the inhabitants of the land before thy people Israel and gave it to the seed of Abraham, your friend, forever? Your friend. And again, in James 2, verse 23, and the scripture was fulfilled, which says, Abraham believed God, and it was imputed unto him for righteousness, and he was called the friend of God. So what is righteousness? Believing God. God will perform everything that he has said he will perform. You come down to Genesis 13, we have Lot. We all know the story of Lot, Sodom, Gomorrah, and so on. And it's just after that, in Genesis 14, Melchizedek makes an entrance. And of course, we know all about Melchizedek. It must have been Christ, because Abraham actually gave him tithes. Then we have the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. Isaac's born in Genesis 21. And Abraham, in Genesis 22, is given the blessings. And God says, and your seed shall possess the gates of your enemies. Now, remember, this is going back 4,000 years ago, approximately. Abraham being around about the 2000 BC mark. Mr. Armstrong says, the nations who were Abraham's racial descendants are to possess the gates of the enemies. A gate is a narrow passage of entrance or exit. When speaking nationally, a gate would be such a pass as the Panama Canal, the Suez Canal, the Straits of Gibraltar, and so on. We can actually add onto that Singapore, Hong Kong, the Cape of Good Hope, the Falkland Islands. These were all gates where we, and by we predominantly the British Empire, also the Americans as far as Panama and so on were concerned, we controlled the entire trade of the entire world. And nobody dared stand up to the Navy, particularly the Royal Navy, because they didn't mess about in those days. They took no prisoners. We were in total control. And that huge empire on which the sun never set was given on a plate. Many countries, there was no fighting. They just seemed to go in and take over. It was utterly amazing what happened. Mr. Armstrong then goes on and says, it is a test. Oh, sorry. He says, either now or in history, who possessed it. Oh, sorry. I'll start from the beginning because grammar gets a bit convoluted here. He said, we must look for the people forming more than one nation, yet all one people, children of Abraham, either now or in history, who possess the sea gateways of the world. Or we must deny the word of God. That's how serious this is. Either this is right or this whole Bible is wrong. He said, it is a test of the inspiration of the Bible and of God's power to rule this world. Did we control the gates of our enemies? You bet we did. Do we control the gates of our enemies today? Gibraltar. Got lost. And we're about to lose that because Spain are clandestinely applying via the EU to get control back of Gibraltar. Why do they want control of Gibraltar? It's just a lump of rock. But you see, it's a lump of rock in the right place that gives you control over the whole Mediterranean. If you control Gibraltar, you can control who goes out, you control who comes in. It's that simple. I can safely say right now, we will lose Gibraltar. Before the end of the age, we will lose it. Then we go Genesis 25. We have Jacob and Esau. Jacob in 27 gets the birthright because Esau despises it. And then we have Joseph. The story of Joseph is totally awesome. Here we have a man who's sold into slavery, ends up in Egypt, had a reasonably sort of cushy job, gets falsely accused, is slung in prison. In prison, I recall, for something like 2 years, manacled, probably leaving him slightly lame. And one day he's in prison, and the next day he's second in command of the most powerful nation on the face of the earth. That's what God can do if he wants somebody in a specific place. It's that simple. That's how simply God can maneuver and put people where he wants them to achieve what he wants to achieve. And Joseph's sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, were blessed in Genesis 48. And Joseph was a bit worried because Jacob crossed his hands on the boys. And the greater blessing went to the younger son. He says, surely his younger brother will be greater than he, and his seed shall become a multitude of nations. If you get an old map and look for the red, because the empire was always in red, and just look at it, it's a tremendous amount. I think it was something like a third of all the people on the planet were governed by the British Empire. Yes. Not anymore. Exodus 1, we go into the Israelites. The Pharaoh arose who did not know Joseph, and the Israelites became slaves. We have the birth of Moses. Gives us some idea of what you've got to do to be a leader. 40 years of being brought up as a prince, a general, and history. Some historians say that Moses was a top general in Egypt. He was very, very high up in the government. He then ends up as a shepherd for 40 years. And I have had the privilege of being around sheep on very, very few occasions. I've seen sheep rugby tackled. I've seen sheep go for the sheepdog. That's why I really enjoy it when they get barbecued, which we're going to be doing on Monday, I believe. You can learn an awful lot herding sheep. I think you can learn a lot more. I see Adele smirking there. You learn an awful lot more herding goats. We went down to their farm, it was a couple of years ago now, and we just had dinner, and my wife had a glass of wine in her hand, and we went up to this to see this one billy goat, who is quite a character. And Sheila's standing, and she brought a banana down to give to the billies, and she's got this glass of wine in one hand, and this goat's up, so his head's quite above Sheila, and he's watching the wine, and she gives him half the banana. Oh, that's fine, he has the banana, but he looks now because the other goat's in the next stall, and he's watching this wine glass, and I was watching the goat. It was too funny. Sheila's now got to lean across to give the other billy the other half of the banana. And he's tracking this glass, and all of a sudden, his head's over, and this huge tongue comes out, and he goes, brrr, and the glass of wine disappeared. And he went, like this. It was absolutely incredible. That's how clever goats are. But that's poor old Moses. What a life. 40 years as a general, 40 years herding sheep, and 40 years, which I'm sure were the worst 40 years, herding the children of Israel. We have the rescue from Egypt, we have the Passover, of the Red Sea being opened up and the Israelites walking through, and then the whole Egyptian army being totally, totally destroyed. It wasn't just the escape from Egypt. Egypt in those days was like, well, probably America today. It was the nation on the face of the earth. And God totally, totally destroyed it. He didn't just bring the Israelites out, he totally trashed Egypt. After that, Egypt ceased to be a world power, totally. In Exodus 20, we have the Ten Commandments given. Then the Ark and the Tabernacle were built. You go to Numbers 14, verse 33, the 40 years of wandering. And this is rather interesting. It shows you God's attitude towards mankind. In Numbers 14, 33, it says, your children shall wander in the wilderness 40 years and bear your whoredoms until your carcasses be wasted in the wilderness. Because these people had rebelled 10 times against God. God was good and angry at them. And yet, he wanted them to learn a lesson. Even then, he looked after them. Deuteronomy 29, verse 5. He said, I have led you 40 years in the wilderness. Your clothes are not waxen old upon you, and your shoe is not waxen old upon your foot. Anybody here got a pair of shoes that's lasted 40 years? I tell you, you get a really expensive pair of shoes these days, you might be lucky if they last 4 years. Moses, before he died, in Deuteronomy 31, was inspired by God to give the people a warning. This is Deuteronomy 31, verse 29. He says, "For I know that after my death you will utterly corrupt yourselves and turn aside from the way which I have commanded you, and evil will befall you in the latter days." Right? "Because you will do evil in the sight of the Eternal and provoke him to anger through the works of your hands." How do you think God reacts when he sees some of the machinations in this country today? When our laws are now, in many cases, totally contrary to God's law. Totally, totally contrary. Then you have Joshua 1, the children of Israel go in to possess the land. And in Joshua 6, we have the fall of Jericho, another great miracle. Interesting, when Joshua is old, in Joshua 23, as he is about to die, here's what he says to the children of Israel. Joshua 23, verse 11, "Take good heed, therefore, unto yourselves, that you love the Eternal your God." Verse 12, "Else, if you do in any wise go back and cleave unto the remnant of these nations, even these that remain among you," and they shouldn't have done because they were supposed to drive them all out. He says, "And shall make marriages with them and go into them and they into you." Verse 13, "Know for a certainty." See, God doesn't mess around. "Know for a certainty that the Eternal your God will no more drive out any of these nations from before you, but they will be snares and traps unto you and scourges in your side and thorns in your eyes until you perish from off this good land which the Eternal your God has given you." You can search your Bible from start to finish. You will never find a Gentile ruling an Israelitish nation. It didn't happen. It has happened now with America. Not a good situation. "And behold, this day I'm going the way of all the earth." He's about to die. "And you know in all your hearts and in all your souls that no one thing has failed of all the good things which the Eternal your God has spoken concerning you." What he's saying is, God has performed every single promise that he's given you to the nth degree. He'd given them this land, which, bearing in mind there were Gentiles living in the land of Israel that they drove out. Gentiles, mind you. And a bunch of grapes was so huge the two spies had to carry it on a pole. So what would it have been like then when the laws of God were applied to that same land? How bountiful would it be? What's it going to be like in the world tomorrow? One bunch of grapes to a barrel of wine. That's truly amazing. That one bunch of grapes can weigh enough that makes two men carry it on a pole. He says, "And not one thing has failed of all the good things which the Eternal your God spoke concerning you. All are come to pass unto you, and not one thing has failed you thereof." Twice he emphasizes the part. God has done everything that he's promised. "Therefore, it shall come to pass that as all good things are come upon you, which the Lord your God promised you, so shall the Eternal bring upon you all evil things until he has destroyed you from off this good land which the Lord your God has given you." Can you imagine the land of America, which takes 8 hours to fly across? It's so big. Desolate. You know, a couple of years ago, I think we were talking about this the other day, it's kind of hard to look at America, such a powerful nation, and think, how is this nation going to be brought down? Anybody got any doubts anymore? All you got to do is think of trillions of dollars of worthless paper flying around and know that the end result of that has got to be a catastrophe. It cannot be anything else. And there's no good Mr. Bernanke saying that he's going to control interest rates and he's going to balance it all up and everything else. It cannot work. God has laid down that the children of Israel, modern day children of Israel, because they've rejected God, he's rejected them, and he will take them off the land and he will take them into captivity. That includes this country as well, and probably some of the Israelitish countries of Europe. They will all be trashed. They will lie desolate. And he says, just as God promised you the good things and they came to pass, the evil things will also come to pass if you don't make the right decisions. Look at the world. Have we made the right decisions as a world? Then we come to the book of Judges. By modern standards, it should be censored, because if you want a plot line for any of your modern soaps, just go into the book of Judges. It's all there. Some of the things they got up to. It's best summed up by Judges 21, verse 25, the last verse in Judges. It said, "In those days there was no king in Israel. Every man did that which was right in his own eyes." You see, they were all clinging on to the wrong tree. Then we have 1 Samuel 1. We have the birth of Samuel. Now Samuel, God's prophet, was chosen literally from conception. From conception. His mother was barren. And she went to the high priest and prayed, and eventually she conceived. But the son, she agreed to dedicate that son to God. And that son was Samuel. So he was chosen literally from conception. But as Samuel got older, his sons didn't follow him. You can read in 1 Samuel 8, verse 3, "And his sons walked not in his ways, but turned aside after lucre and took bribes and perverted judgments. Then all the elders of Israel gathered themselves together and came to Samuel at Ramah and said unto him, 'Behold, you are old, and your sons walk not in your ways. Now make us a king.'" And of course, God then turned around to Samuel and said, "Don't worry, they're not against you, they're against me. But we'll give them a king." So we had King Saul, who made the wrong decisions. Totally made the wrong decisions and lost out. Then we had King David, not just a friend of God, a man after God's own heart, a man who thought as God thinks. That's why we sing these psalms. This is how God thinks. If you look at the hymns we sing, look at the words. That is like God literally speaking through David. And as I read on the Feast of Trumpets, when they dedicated the temple, they sang the words of David, just as we sing the words of David today. Sounds like a good idea. You then have 721 to 718 BC, Israel goes into captivity. The Assyrians come down, take them away, scatter them all over Europe, and they become the lost 10 tribes. And then, a short time later, in history terms, 604 to 585, Judah then follows into Babylon. But here again, this was slightly different. They went into captivity for a specific period, 70 years. At the end of that 70 years, Ezra and Nehemiah, by a miracle, where God just changed Cyrus's heart. He called Cyrus his servant. Cyrus was a violent and bloody man, as any Gentile king is in history, right? But God manipulated him, got him to do the right thing. Ezra and Nehemiah were sent back. And after the troublous times, as it says, the temple was rebuilt. But of course, the decisions got all made the wrong way. And again, it all went off track. We come to the New Testament. Christ is born. He has a 3.5-year ministry. His death, his resurrection, which we all know about. And Pentecost. In the holiday booklet, it says, "The New Testament dispensation began on Sunday, June the 17th, 31 AD. That's when the church started. On that day, the Holy Spirit came to dwell within flesh, as prophesied by Joel." That's what Mr. Armstrong wrote in the holiday booklet. We then read of the Apostle Paul's great work. What an amazing man Paul was. I don't think physically anyone could keep up with him. I mean, he had shipwrecks, he was beaten, it's just incredible what that man went through. But he stuck to his guns, and at the end of it all, he said, "Henceforth there's a crown of righteousness laid up for me. I've run the race. I've made it." That's the confidence that Paul had, knowing that the next day, in all probability, he would literally lose his head, which is probably arguably better than the way a lot of the other men died. Most of the apostles died horrendous deaths. You look at Stephen, for instance, literally torn apart by a vicious mob. Some were crucified upside down, according to tradition. Utterly unbelievable. Only the Apostle John survived to literally die in bed. And as he was old, probably a similar type age to Mr. Armstrong, pushing 100 years old, he was given the revelation, the revealing. It's not the revealing of John, it's the revelation of Jesus Christ. He wrote it down, and then he died. And that is more or less the end of the story for 2,000 years. We had people who survived through the European trouble, trying to obey God here and there, but there was no work, you know, done as of today. And we come up then to this period in time. So here we are now. Basically, also what happened then, of course, is we have the Catholic Church, which came from Peter, but not the same Peter that we're talking about. And we know what happened. And within 100, 150 years, religion had completely changed. There was now a gospel about Christ, not about what Christ said. I mean, if you think about what we know, we sit here today celebrating in advance the world tomorrow, 1,000 years of what? 1,000 years where the whole world will be ruled by Jesus Christ here on this earth, where everybody will be forced to be happy, forced to be prosperous. They may well even possibly live the whole 1,000 years if things are restored to what they were before the flood. Can you think of a life that would be better than that? Where the sower is overtaking the reaper. Where everybody has their own vine and their own fig tree. Where you can have children knowing they're not going to be slaughtered in some stupid war like in Afghanistan today, for instance. People, real young lads, and they go all the way out there, and then a couple of weeks later they come back in a box. I die for his country. Wonderful. And it's happening all too often. That's all gone. And you tell this to people and they go, yeah, right. Well, they said, well, yeah, right, when people, you know, Mr. Armstrong, as we'll see in a minute, when he made certain predictions about the future that have come to pass. But God performs. So here we are at the time of the end. We've had 6,000 years of history. Few people have ever understood this basic master plan that God actually has. It was revealed to Mr. Armstrong around 80 years ago now. It's rather interesting going back in history. If you look at Enoch, Enoch preached for 300 years and then he was taken away, right? Enoch witnessed to everybody in the Old Testament except one man, Noah. Noah was born 80 years after. God had to reveal everything again to Noah. God had to reveal everything again to Abraham. And so it goes the way through. God had to reveal everything to Mr. Armstrong. It's revealed knowledge. You can't get it out of book. So let's go on to point number 2, chocolate. Yes. I want you now to try and use your imagination. Okay. You're in a large supermarket on your own. It's pitch inky black, right? No light at all. You have a candle, which is lit now, and you have a crumpled piece of paper in your hand, which you smooth out, and it's a plan of the whole store. Now, supermarkets do this because it seems like every month, everything gets moved around the shelves, so that when you go for the eggs, they're no longer on aisle 9, they're now on aisle 7 at the other end, and so on. It's to confuse the shopper and make you walk all the way up and down so that you buy more. Okay, so you have this candle and you want to find the chocolate. You can't have a piece of that chocolate. I mean, come on. Now, you smooth this crumpled floor plan out and you look down and you see, well, the first area is the vegetables. So you walk slowly with your candle and the shapes start coming out of the darkness. And there it is, the broccoli and the leeks and the onions. Okay, you go past there and then you come to freezers. Oh yeah, that's the meat section, followed by the ready meals. Now, a few years ago, it used to be a meat section, full stop. And it used to be like 4 or 5 aisles in the supermarket. In our local Walmart, Asda, the meat section is now literally one aisle, and the ready meals one is like three aisles. And when you look at the contents of some of the ready meals, I'd be frightened to set a match near them because they might explode. There's so many chemicals in them. And you go on a bit further, and there's the spices, and then the next one you've got the pasta and rice, and you think, okay, fine. Get to number six, and sure enough, there's the sauces on the bottom there, they should be. Number seven, there's all the canned food there. Number eight, potato crisps, chips, whatever, depending on which part of the Commonwealth countries you come from. Coffee, tea, sugar. Sure enough, it's there. Aisle number 10, it's all the baking stuff, all the flour and all the goodies that go to making cakes and so on. Gets more interesting now. Aisle number 11's all the cakes. Mr. Kipling's apple pies. Aisle number 12, you'd end all biscuits, all the cookies. And you stop now and you think, hang on, I'm at aisle number 12. And everything on this sheet has been absolutely perfect. This has got to be the floor plan that's in operation for this store now. Right? So you look down at the floor plan, you say, where's the chocolate? Aisle 15. You don't have to check 13 and 14. You can go straight to 15, down the ball, left-hand side. There's all the chocolate, right? It's there because you've got the floor plan. You've proved the floor plan all the way through. All the aisles were absolutely where they should have been. You get to 15 and there's the chocolate. Take it as the chocolate being the millennium. Yeah? You can now look at that plan and think, ooh, if I go two more aisles up, there's the booze, the alcohol. Take that as being the white throne judgment period. And in the middle of the aisle, there's a break and there's a door. That's the exit. That's the beginning. You see, we've got the store plan. We've got this plan of God, which is just like a store plan. It's been laid out. It was all laid out 6,000 years ago. God the Father and Jesus Christ planned the whole thing. And the whole thing is to teach the whole of mankind certain lessons. Because the whole of mankind eventually will have that opportunity to make the right decision and become sons of God. Immortal. I mean, that is, it's too stunning to take in, isn't it? And yet nobody wants to believe it. They want to believe about gentle Jesus, meek and mild. They won't think about that when he comes back for the second time. They'll hide in the rocks. God revealed his plan through Mr. Herbert Armstrong, his end time apostle. And we've checked through 6,000 years, and you can see God's performance. God has always followed that floor plan. It's not failed at any stage. If he's told them, if you're going to do this, that's going to happen. They didn't obey him. Israel went into captivity. Now, you would have thought, when Israel went into captivity, and the Assyrian then besieged Jerusalem at the same time, that's at the time of Hezekiah, and there was the big kerfuffle there where, you know, he went, he had Isaiah come in there, and there was much praying going on and so on. And God says, okay, he'll go back to his nation and he'll be killed. And Sennacherib, the leader, went back and he was worshiping in his pagan temple, and his sons came and slew him. Just as God said. You can check all these things in history. God has not failed once. So what I'd like to do now, before the next point, if you want to make a few notes here, I want to give you a very, very brief overview of history over the last 80 years. So it's something I am working on, hopefully, for the website. What I want to do is I want to, a history of Mr. Armstrong, what he was preaching about at different times, and what was happening in the world. Because you can see, you know, some people say, oh, well, that happened, and then he preached this. So we'll see a few things in a minute. October 1929... on the very week of the Week of Tabernacles, on the Thursday, the feast in 1929 was Sabbath to Sabbath, as is this feast. On the Thursday during the feast was the initial collapse of the stock market. On the Monday and Tuesday after the feast, the bottom fell out of it. And the rest, as they say, is history. January the 30th, as a result of this, Adolf Hitler became Chancellor of Germany. Right? He did not seize power. He was given it. He was elected. Always remember that. He was actually elected to power. 1936 to 1939, you have the Spanish Civil War. That was important because what happened then was Germany was backing one of the groups in Spain, and that's where they were testing and trying their methods of warfare. The Stuka dive bomber made its first appearance in the Spanish Civil War. Then we have the fateful day again round about September the 1st in 1939, World War II starts. August the 15th, May 1945, Germany surrenders, followed in August the 15th, Japan actually surrendering. After the Americans went across and did the job on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And people have criticized this, but others have said, who are in the know, if they hadn't done that, the dead soldiers that an American would have lost, because the Japanese would not surrender. They did not understand the word. It was the biggest dishonor anybody can do. That's why they treated our prisoners of war so harshly. They're not men. They gave up. And there's some horrific scenes of taking over some of those islands there where they literally had to burn these people out of the ground. Use flamethrowers. They were dug in foxholes. They'd blast them with a flamethrower. They wouldn't give up. They'd play dead, and as you went past, they'd turn around and shoot them back. They fought for every inch of the land, and they died with honor. How you die with honor, I don't know. You still die, don't you? But those two bombs changed the whole psyche of the Japanese people, and they surrendered. And isn't it not interesting that Japan, of course, is one of the great trading nations in the world today? Okay, so let's look at point number three, the floor plan for the last 80 years. Early in the 20th century, God calls up Mr. Armstrong. Summer of 1926, he's challenged by his wife on the Sabbath question. That is interesting. The first thing, the first challenge is on God's Sabbath. God's Sabbath, he created a creation. It was the seventh day. So the Sabbath was created by God. It's special. And here we are on a double Sabbath today. And what happened when things started going wrong in the church? The Sabbath is no longer required. And I remember having a discussion with one minister, and I said, well, hold on. The Sabbath was created at creation. You come on through, the holy days then are mentioned and tied in. They were supposed to have been kept all through the 6,000 years, but they've been kept spasmodically. You go to Zechariah, and then we hear that the Feast of Tabernacles is going to be kept. And if people don't keep it, they're in for a rough time. God will make people keep his holy days. But for this one little tiny piece of time now, they're done away with. So you explain that one. Ah, but you know, we're under the new covenant, etc., etc., etc. Mr. Armstrong, the first thing he was tried on was the Sabbath. Sort the Sabbath out. You see, once you sort the Sabbath out, you can't sort the Sabbath question out without admitting there is a God, because God created that Sabbath. And once you admit there's a God, what's the next thing you go for? Evolution. If there's a God, whoo, so where does this lot come from? I know we used to joke at college because one of the words that was spouted around was uniformitarianism, right? Basically, the belief in people who believe in evolution, everything's uniform and everything's gone slowly over millions of years. These dinosaurs would die in a swamp and they'd slowly slink into the swamp and down they go, and over the millennia, junk would get put on top of them. It would be compressed. And what happens to an animal that dies out in the field? Go back in 12 months. What's left? I'll tell you something, you go into Africa where the climate's hot and you leave a dead animal lying on the ground. Yes. We saw an ox once that had been killed and taken in a controlled environment, in a game reserve, but the lions were free, you were in your car. And they dumped this ox on the ground and the female lioness walks up first and literally ripped the hindquarter off. Now, a hindquarter can weigh, what, 60, 70 kilos? She literally ripped it off this animal, and she picked it up, and she dragged it away, and then we followed her down, and there she was. She had three cubs. And then the others all piled in. The old male lion, he absolutely does no work at all, basically. Here's all the women do all the work. They're well organized, the lions. within a space of 2 hours, we got around the camp and came back, and there was nothing. There wasn't any bones left. So these dinosaurs somehow miraculously got fossilized. You know, to create a fossil, you've got to get this thing and immediately seal it, get all the air out of it, and then compress it under great compression to form a fossil. The fossils were created by a catastrophe. There can be no question about it. If you look back in history, there are catastrophe after catastrophe after catastrophe. And we're heading up for another one very shortly. This world hasn't always been nice and gentle. Neither has our solar system. There's plenty of proof on that one. So he was challenged again on evolution. Summer of 1927, he says, "My wife and I learned an exciting, shocking truth. The resurrection of Christ did not occur on Sunday morning." You see, this is revealed knowledge. Everybody's tied into Good Friday, Easter Sunday. How you get 3 days and three nights from Friday evening to Sunday morning, it's a bit like doing calculus. I don't know if anybody did calculus in school, right? I lost it the first day when the teacher got up and said, "The answer is not necessarily always the same. It's the method that's important." And I thought, if I've got one orange and I add another orange to it, I've got two oranges. It's always two oranges. You can't really, if you squeeze all the juice out of them and put the juice in one cup and you've got all the bits over here, you've still got two oranges. No. Maths. Higher maths. I never learned to speak in algebra either. Yeah. He said, "I had found that opponents of God's Sabbath can invent some 57 varieties of arguments to explain why they didn't keep the Sabbath." For those who don't know it, there's a company called Heinz who used to advertise they had 57 varieties. Now, he says, "But they only have one argument for observing Sunday, and that is the supposition that on Sunday of the Sunday morning resurrection. That's the day of the Lord. According to Paul, it's a working day. Told to collect an offering up on the first day of the week. It was a physical thing they had to do. It was food they were collecting. It wasn't a church service. But that is the only authority that the Catholics have. And all these Protestant denominations around the world that keep Sunday are keeping Sunday because of the authority of the Catholic Church." 1928, 80 years ago, here are some of the subjects Mr. Armstrong was actually writing about. Here are titles of things he was writing about. "The Sabbath, the Perpetual Covenant? Question mark. Can a Sabbath keeper believe in evolution? Planting the evolutionary concept in your child's mind. Does the Eternal heal the sick today? On what day was Christ crucified?" Mr. Armstrong was going over this sort of stuff in 1928. The articles are on the internet. You can get them still. Let's leap forward to 1950. This is the August Plain Truth, 1950. "Contrary to most self-professed authorities," capital letters, inverted commas, as Mr. Armstrong used to write, "on Bible prophecy, no all-out full-scale war is prophesied between Russia and the United States. No all-out full-scale war is prophesied between Russia and the United States. 1948 to 1949, I forgot to mention, was the Berlin airlift. When Russia closed, you know, Berlin was actually in East Germany, and there's a corridor they had where they were allowed to take supplies, and the Russians closed the corridor. No problem to America. Huge airlift. They just airlifted food in. Continual stream of planes flying over. But there's no war. We had the Cold War. Remember the Cuba crisis when the Russians were going to set up intercontinental ballistic missiles on Cuba? And the US president said they were on a ship. They knew they were on the ship steaming towards Cuba. And the US president just turned to the Russians and he said, check your radar, guys. There are B-52s coming at you from all angles. If that ship crosses that parallel on the map, they will get the order to come in there and flatten your whole nation. The ship turned round. Mr. Armstrong said, 1950, way before any of this, no all-out war is prophesied between Russia and America. 1950, August Plain Truth. Now, in 1950, I can remember playing on bomb sites. Much of Britain was still a mess. Europe was still trash from the war. Mr. Armstrong said, the plain truth, August 1950, the world will be stunned to see Germany emerge suddenly as a power never equaled by Hitler, by a union of 10 nations, probably including some of the present puppets of Russia, in a gigantic United States of Europe. Do you realize what he's actually saying there? Stunned. I'll say they'd be stunned. Europe still in a terrible mess from the war. I mean, we were, as I say, where we were living, there was the bomb sites all over the place. They were commonplace. Britain was still on food rationing. Before the war, Britain imported 55 million tons of food a month. When the war started, that dropped down to 12 million tons a month. So they brought out food rationing. You got ration books for meat, eggs, butter, as I'll show you in a minute. And each of these things carried a point, so many points. And at the end, and on top of all this, you had 16 free points that you could buy with whatever you wanted. If you wanted an extra bit of cheese, you could use those points to buy cheese. That continued until 1954. I can remember, I was 10 years old, going down to the village shop in my ration book and asking for my ration of sweets. And the woman said, no, there's no more rations. You've got to buy the ounces now. You can buy as much as you want. And I went home to my mother. I said, she won't give me my sweets. Now, my mother could be a female version of, a Scottish female version of Adolf Hitler. You didn't mess with her kids down to the shop in her broadest Scottish accent. Why can't my wee Wayne have his sweets? And this lady had to then explain that rations gone, stop. There's the notice from the government. 1954. So what was the typical Briton getting during that period? 2 ounces of butter a week. 2 ounces of butter a week, yes? We've got witnesses here of these things. They're all nodding. 4 ounces of bacon or ham. 4 ounces of margarine. 8 ounces of sugar. 3 pints of milk a week, right? Sometimes 2, depending on the supply. Yeah, I wouldn't last long in your house, would it? Meat to the value of 1 shilling and tuppence, which in today's money is like nothing, virtually. 2 ounces of cheese. Yes, Alex, I know you put 4 ounces on your spaghetti bolognese. One fresh egg a week. 2 ounces of tea. A 1 pound jar of jam every 2 months. Dried eggs, 1 packet every 4 weeks. Sweets, oh my sweets, 12 ounces every 4 weeks. The world will be stunned to see Germany emerge suddenly in a power never equaled by Hitler. And that's the mess this country was in at that time when he said that. Germany was just literally, with the Marshall Plan and so on, starting to rebuild their industry. Is he right? Was Mr. Armstrong right? Well, the fulfillment of the 10 nations is a short way off now. But lying, cheating, stealing, doing all the conniving behind closed doors, it looks like they're going to force through this treaty. Whether it goes through or not is really of no consequence, because they've just said, well, if it doesn't go through, we'll just keep on going anyway. Today, stunning though it may seem, Germany is the number one country in the world when it comes to exports. $1.53 trillion last year, as opposed to America, which was $300 billion less. Now, when you look at the country the size of America and you look at the country the size of Germany, you realize what you're up against. And don't forget, 10 nations are going to give, or kings, are going to give their power to this grouping, which of course obviously is going to include Germany, the world will have never seen the like. Mr. Armstrong was talking about this 50 and 60 years ago. And we're living at a time when it's all coming to fruition. 1955. Oh, sorry. Oh, beg your pardon. Yes. April 1952. Okay. I was 8 years old. Mr. Armstrong wrote, Russia may give East Germany back to the Germans. Remember that after the war, the Russians grabbed half of Germany and will be forced to relinquish her control over Hungary, Czechoslovakia, parts of Austria to complete the 10-nation union. Do you realize what this is saying? This is actually saying that the Berlin Wall was going to come down before it even went up. I mean, how ahead of the time do you want? He's saying East Germany is going to be given back to the Germans. German reunification in 1952, when the whole place was in ruins, Mr. Armstrong's getting up there and saying, this is what's going to happen. Anybody want to argue about it? Go across to Germany now. Walk through the Brandenburg Gate. The last time I was there, I had a guy looking at me down the sights of a rifle, which is a bit scary. P.T., June 1955, talking about the Holy Roman Empire. Mr. Armstrong says, in its final phase to appear in our day will merely be a restoration of the ancient Roman Empire, a United States of Europe, which we are beginning to foster within the confines of the ancient Roman Empire. We are building the Frankenstein monster that is destined to destroy us. America, after the war, went in there and they gave them the money and the expertise to rebuild all their industry. Not Britain. Our steelworks in the 50s and 60s were still using technology from the 20s, right? Germany had the very latest technology going, given to them by America. So suddenly they were producing stuff at a quarter of the price that we could do in England. So the vanquished effectively became the victor. And America predominantly supplied all the cash. Crazy. The Russians had the right idea. They went into East Germany and just ripped it clean. They took all the factories out and put them back in Russia. They left East Germany as a farming nation. And they kept them right under the thumb because they knew the dangers of Germany. I remember Mr. Frank Schnee, the regional director years ago in Germany. He said to me, the German people are lovely people. But he says, do not put a uniform on them. He says, even a bus conductor. He says, the minute he gets a bus conductor on the bus, he says, the heels get to click and the arm shoots up. It's all they understand. They don't mean to, it says in the Bible, they don't mean to be like this. But they're a tool that God's using to correct Israel. Mr. Armstrong's talking about this in 1955. If you look at Europe, Western, the European nations created the Council of Europe in 1949 as a very, very loose idea. There was a French Foreign Minister, Robert Schuman, who is, I think, Teutonic in origins, wanted to get France and Germany, and some of the Benelux countries, well, actually, it was Germany, France, Italy, Netherlands, Belgium, and Luxembourg. He wanted those six nations to get together and pool their natural resources on coal, iron, and steel. And the theory was that if they tied it and made it completely open within those six nations, that all the productivity would be monitored by all six nations, all at the same price, that it would stop any further chance of war, because nobody in that situation could then create a war machine to tackle anybody else. Bearing in mind that Europe had been in an upheaval for a long time. That was how the EU started. In 51, they actually got that going. 1957, the Treaty of Rome was signed in March 1957. That created the original European common market, again with these same six nations. In 1956, a year before, Mr. Armstrong says, this is the December 56 plain truth, the way is being prepared for a colossal third force in world politics, a European federation of nations more powerful than either Russia or the United States. We have shown years in advance what would happen to Russia's ill-fated empire in Eastern Europe. Now, if you understand the politics of the situation, the Berlin Wall literally surrounded, the whole border was completely guarded. We went down there from college and we were able to see. They had about 100 yards swathe of land, completely full of minefields. They had guard posts with machine guns all the way along. It was like something out of science fiction. When you went into Eastern Germany, it was another planet. Everything, no advertising. The only thing that was of any color was portraits of Lenin on the side of the blocks of flats. Everybody was dull, drab, and dreary. You come back into West Berlin, and it was a mega city, bright lights, and like any city, but very clean, very organized. Mr. Anstrom was saying, they're going to join up. And he's saying that the Eastern Empire, Russia, Bulgaria, Poland, all these nations, and what happened to them? Again, it just literally crumbled over a weekend. The Hungarians opened the border, and then Honecker in East Germany was sick over the weekend or something, or so the excuse goes. And by Monday morning, the Berlin Wall was breached. People were traveling freely through. And it seems that a very short time after that, all the Eastern European nations got their independence from Russia. Mr. Armstrong first mentioned that in 1952. 52. It happened in the late 80s. December 63, plain truth. So long as present German prosperity continues, the Nazi takeover will not be possible. But should any severe threat to the hard-won prosperity come, the picture will change violently in Germany. Remember, it was the aftermath of the disastrous stock market crashes of 1924 and 1929 that fanned the flames of violence in Germany to pave the way for Hitler. Because Hitler went to the German people and he said, we can stop all this nonsense. But you got your money on a Friday, you rushed the shops to spend it all, because by Monday it was virtually worthless. It was the same as Zimbabwe. And I reckon there's a very good chance it's going to be the same in Britain and America very shortly. And all this currency that we're all printing like crazy. And to add to the problem, by the way, there are people out there now forging notes like crazy. I had that experience on Friday when I went shopping. The couple in front of me were paying with £20 notes. And look at your £20 notes. There's a disc on there which has got another watermark, the hologram. And you can turn it, and it'll say like 20, and then it gives you another sign. And if they're not doing that, then you've got a forgery. You've got a forgery. The feel of the paper is slightly different. But I put a £10 note on my scanner because I couldn't afford a £20 note. And scanned it through and just printed it on ordinary paper and cut it up and put the two on the table. And at first glance, you can't tell the difference. And it's not that I've got a great scanner. This scanner we bought from, what, 6-7 years ago. All that changes is silver. The little silver bits weren't quite right. A currency literally is getting to the stage where it's worthless. And the reason it's worthless, let's say you win the lottery and you've got £1 million. And you go to the bank and you say to you, Mr. Bank, I want to invest my £1 million. Do you know what the bank does? On the strength of that, it immediately loans out, 10 times that much. 10 times. And sometimes it's even more than that. And the reason is they reckon that nobody will ever come back and claim all the money back at the same time. So they're about to rob Peter to pay Paul. Now, unfortunately, they got caught up. Mr. Armstrong was talking about this 40 years ago. Plain truth, October 64. United Germany, with her former territories restored, is ready to emerge as the strongest nation on earth. 1964, it didn't happen until 1989. And here's Mr. Armstrong going on about it, prophesying it. He's saying, this is it. This is what God revealed to him. People were laughing at this. I had this, you know, going to press conferences and talking to people. I've had people say to me, oh, you're that Armstrong guy. Yeah, this whole thing. Oh, it's a joke. It's a joke. It's happened. Plain truth, 65, April 65. In spite of Mr. Churchill's farsightedness, he could not foresee that this great political, religio-economic power block of 10 nations not only would refuse Britain membership in the final United States of Europe, that is, the 10, but will ultimately prove the undoing of the Anglo-Saxon people of America, Britain, and the Commonwealth countries. Could that happen? Well, if the Conservatives get in and have a vote as to whether we should stay in Europe or not, it's almost certain that the answer will be very firmly no. Because a lot of people are fed up to the teeth with all the silly regulations and restrictions that Europe's putting on us. And of course that would give Europe then the chance to come in and take us over. Because under the terms of the treaty, if one member state starts reneging on the agreement, the other member states can come in and take them over. It's all in that agreement. And people haven't read it. That's the problem. Same in America with the Patriot Act. The same in America with this new healthcare thing. The document's 10,000 pages, I believe, on the healthcare thing. Nobody can possibly read that. It'd take you days. And that's how they describe, that's how they put it in. They brought laws in this country about children. Now, Paula gets a letter there. It's a letter addressed to her, a government letter addressed to an 8-year-old child explaining why or not she should have a certain measles shot. What a child at 8 can make that decision? No, what the government's doing is they're taking that responsibility away from a parent, which is the ultimate idea of communism. You had your baby, it was chucked in the nursery, you went back to work. And the state reared them up and made little clones of them so they could go back out and do the work on the collective farm or whatever they were trained for. Do you realize today's modern educational system was set up by the money from people like Mr. Ford and Mr. Carnegie, who run the steel industry in America? And why? They wanted schools to create clones to go in and work in their industry. Get them up to a certain degree of education so they could go zip, 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 and put four nuts on a bolt, on a wheel, on a car, or whatever. And they get this ghastly production. If you've ever seen, I've seen it, you go on these production lines. And there's a man there, literally, and all he did was he picked up a wheel and stuck it on and put the screws on and went zip, 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 zip. And he turned around and he picked the next wheel and the car already gone, and the next car was there, and he put the same wheel on. There's somebody else doing the front one. He's doing the back one. And they do that for 8 hours a day. And Satan's world. How can anybody like that have anything within their mind that's creative? You can't. You're just a clone. The rise of Islam. This goes up to 1979. Plain Truth Magazine, December 79. Islam waits to be united. The role of the Mahdi, the great unifier of Islam, waits a player. There is no reason to believe that the days of Mahdiism are past. Indeed, circumstances in the Muslim world appear riper now than ever for a Mahdi to flare up. Even now, a Mahdi may be waiting in the wings for the opportune moment. And 1 year later, December 1980, Bible prophecy reveals the coming emergence of an Arab-Muslim confederation in the Middle East. The Bible refers to the leader of this group as the King of the South, Daniel 11:40. This confederation will play a crucial role in end-time events. Okay, 79. A few months ago, in the news, Muslims around the world are awaiting a leader, the Mahdi. The president of Iran, Mohammad Ahmadinejad, he's been around a long time now, I can pronounce his name. They think that the coming of the Mahdi will happen within the next 2 years. He said that a couple of months ago. And what's he doing? He said, my job is to prepare the way for him. You see, the Mahdi is going to appear at a time of great trouble and confusion. He's been living down a well for the last 800 years or something. And he'll suddenly appear, this great leader, who will unite the Muslim world, which is not really united at the moment. I mean, you have 400 or 500 million Arabs surrounding a state of Israel where there are, wait for it, 6 million Jews and 1 million Israeli Arabs. And they've tried everything since 1948 to take that country over. And the reason that Israel wants to be recognized as a Jewish state is, if they recognize Israel as a Jewish state, then all those people who the Israelis chucked out in 1948, according to the one version, will not be able to come back. The truth of the matter is that the Arabs told their own people in Israel, get out by this date, we're going to come in and take over, and we'll have the whole country under our control. But it didn't work that way, because anybody who tangles with Israel ends up with a bloody nose. I think the Israeli Air Force, as I recall, consisted of 3 Spitfires. Right? That's all they had. And the guts. And they beat the tar out of everybody, much to everybody's surprise. And the State of Israel took off, and it's never looked back. Oh, they've been attacked, and they've had all sorts of problems. But they're still there. 6 million Jews, 400 million Arabs. That could change. We need to watch that situation very carefully. 1981, the Pope. Pope John Paul II, this is the previous Pope, has worked feverishly to revive the Holy Roman Empire. Early in his pontificate in Spain, November the 9th, 1981, he said, it can be said that the European identity is not understandable without Christianity. What he means is Catholicism. Find yourself again. Be yourself. Discover your origins. Revive your roots. Return to those authentic values that made your history a glorious one and your presence so beneficent to the other countries. Like the Crusades were beneficent to other countries. We know that at the end time, the Bible says that these people will kill some of God's people and they will think they're doing God a service. Now, is that a Catholic attitude? Well, fighting in the Pope's cause was not only an obligation, it made you righteous. Please try and sit still in this. I know it makes you a bit edgy and you want to laugh. This is what Catholics believe, right? With that one idea, mass political action was launched. With that one idea, ideology was born. With that one idea, the crusade was set in motion. And how do they think? What's governing the grey cells? But killing, the Pope now declared, need not be a sin after all. It depended on whom you killed. In fact, if you kill the enemies of Christ, starting to feel a bit uncomfortable? Killing did not require further penance. In fact, it was the penance. Holy slaughter could be as effective a devotional activity as prayer or fasting or pilgrimage. I just hope nobody quotes me out of context there. That's the Catholic mindset. That's what we're going to be faced with in a very, very short time. And it's all going to come about because of a total world financial collapse. A crisis that will hit everybody, where people will be wandering around not knowing what to do, and one man will stand up and he will say, here's the plan. And 10 nations will say, yes, sir, boss, we're with you. And Britain won't. And the rest, as they say, is history. In the United States and Britain in Prophecy, the last edition, 1980, but the division that was written about 1954, I believe. This is the United States. It says, the yoke of slavery without mercy is to be laid on the US and Britain by the coming United Nations of Europe. It has started already through the economic common market and the recently implemented European monetary system. Its leaders talk continually of political union, which means also military. On the news last week, if you check, you'll see that the French minister has said that whether Britain likes it or not, within the next 1, 2, or 3 years, there will be a European command with a large army to defend, of course, Europe. You must always remember, an army is for defense. Always defense. Yeah, right. In his closing warning, Mr. Armstrong says, by God's direction and authority, I have laid the truth before you. To neglect it will be tragic beyond imagination. To heed it will bring blessings, happiness, and glory beyond description. The decision is now yours. Interesting what Mr. Bowles was talking about last night. That's what Mr. Armstrong said. The decision is yours. Most of us here have come here by a very rocky road. We've had to face up to people who changed beliefs. We've had to stand on our own 2 feet and say, this is what I believe. And that's why we're here. It's a decision. We had the apostasy. How subtle it was. How subtle it was. I have here a letter, the other copy of which my wife made in a paper airplane out and threw him behind the wardrobe in one of our houses. I saved this one. You didn't know I had it, did you? This is the famous letter of April 17, 1995, where Mr. Descartes says that those of you who want to make merchandise of you tell you that certain teachings of Mr. Armstrong are what you should cling to. Specifically, the teaching of the Sabbath and holy days are required for Christians. You see, the first thing he went for was the Sabbath and the holy days. And then, and I have checked up that I'm not going to mess up anybody's offering sermonette with this one. Brethren, I must also ask you to be specifically generous with your offerings on the last holy day of unleavened bread. These offerings are a voluntary expression of our love of Jesus Christ and the support of his work throughout the church. Sounds all right, it's reasonable. We take them up on holy days as a tradition and not as a commandment of God. Whoops! You see how subtle it is? But, wait for it. Yes, brethren, I must tell you that we do really need these offerings, especially at this time when this rebellion has so negatively affected the church's income. You see, if you don't agree with this, you're in rebellion. Oh, welcome to the rebels. Deuteronomy 16, verse 16 is not a suggestion. It is a command. But you see, their idea was the Old Testament's old. What are we doing here? Point number four. If you look at the prophets and the apostles, they were witnesses for what happened in their time. We are witnesses of the end time. Acts 10:39, Peter says, we are talking about the apostles. He says, we are witnesses of all things which he did both in the land of the Jews and in Jerusalem, whom they slew and hanged on a tree. Him God raised up on the third day and showed him openly, not to all people, but unto witnesses chosen before God. And in 1 Corinthians 15, verse 6, just make a note of it, after that he was seen of above 500 brethren at once. This obviously was between the time of his resurrection and Pentecost. At one time, 500 people eyeballed him, eyeball to eyeball, standing in front of them, well alive. Probably preaching and teaching to them. 500. Plus all the others that he appeared to. Only 120 at Pentecost. Think about it. We are the link between this age and the world tomorrow. That's what we're celebrating this week. We're going into this world tomorrow. We're going to be taught about what happens, how it works together, where we're going to be, and so forth and so on. We've got to look back at the prophets. God always performed what he said he would perform. We can look back to the apostles. God, again, always performed what he said he would perform. Is Germany reunited? Is Germany the world's leading exporting nation? Has Britain gone down the tubes? We can't even produce a motor car now in this country. We even import plastic carrier bags from Indonesia. Everything else is made in China. We are American brethren who are having parts of their fighter planes made in China. That's really a cool idea. I don't know. We have the floor plan. We can see 6,000 years. Can we not look forward and say, well, the last little bit's going to be exactly as it says on the floor plan? It's got to happen. It simply cannot not happen. It's that simple. And point number five, are you an alien? Turn to 1 Peter 2, verse 11. In his first epistle, the Apostle Peter points out to us, Dearly beloved, I beseech you as strangers and pilgrims. Strangers and pilgrims are resident aliens. This isn't our world. If you see the confidence of God's end-time apostle writing in the wonderful world tomorrow, yeah, we keep the feast. We're looking at 6,000 years now. We're now looking into the future. And this is what Mr. Armstrong says. This is the introduction to the Wonderful World Tomorrow booklet. You don't have to believe it. It will happen regardless. It is sure. The world's only sure hope. This advanced good news of tomorrow is as certain as the rising of tomorrow's sun. Humanity won't bring it about. It's going to be done to us. Humanity is going to be forced to be happy, to enjoy world peace, and to see universal abundance and joy fill the earth. How's that for a statement? No ifs, ands, and buts, no get-out clauses, straight from the shoulder. He says, utopia? Why not? Because that's what the Bible pictures. That's what we're going to be seeing this week as we go through the different sermons and sermonettes. Everything's going to be aimed and channeling us into seeing what this is going to be like. And Mr. Armstrong says, and what will this wonderful world tomorrow be like? How will it be governed? Who will rule? Well, I advise you to stay tuned for the rest of the week and we'll find out.